31. There was nothing more that could be done to slow the ship's tumbling motion. Auger kept the shutter open, and periodically one of them would climb up and examine the view, but the safest and easiest thing was to stay strapped into their seats. Damaged as it was, the transport did not actually seem to be getting any worse. No more systems had broken down since their emergence around Mars, and the cabin pressure had stabilized at just under one-third of an atmosphere. It was too thin to sustain life, so they kept the masks on, but at least they did not have the chill of vacuum to contend with. With the battery-powered heater still running, the ambient temperature was low, but not unbearably so. "We're safe for now," Auger said. "All we have to do is sit tight until someone figures out where we are."
"And someone will manage that?"
"Count on it. They'll be scouring every centimeter of space looking for us right now. Even if there isn't a working transponder on this thing, they'll find us with their own sensors. It will only be a matter of time." Her confidence had a thin, brittle edge to it, like ice that might break at any moment.
"I take it from this that you have a theory about how we survived?" Floyd asked.
"Aveling's people must have taken the decision to destroy Phobos," she said. "That smudge of dust and gas is all that's left of the moon. We must have hit a little debris coming through it, but not enough to do us any harm."
"They blew up a whole moon? Isn't that rather drastic?"
"It was the only way to save us," she said. "They must have picked up our bow shock distortion and realized that we were coming in much too fast to decelerate into the recovery bubble. But the bubble's only function was to maintain vacuum at the wormhole throat. If they got rid of the pressurized chamber, and Phobos with it, then they wouldn't need the bubble. We'd have been emerging into vacuum anyway."
"But you said they wouldn't have much warning of our imminent arrival," Floyd said.
"They must have had a procedure in place for just this contingency," she said. "Emergency evacuation measures to get everyone off the moon in a couple of minutes. Nuclear demolition charges sewn throughout the whole thing, ready to take it apart at the press of a button, giving us a clear route to space."
"All that in a couple of minutes?"
"There's no other explanation, Floyd."
"Well, I can think of one off the top of my head. Somebody else blew up that moon, and our arrival didn't have a damn thing to do with it."
"No, Floyd," she said patiently, as if lecturing a child on some arcane matter of the adult world. "Nobody else blew up that moon. That's not the way we do things around here. We may be in a state of crisis, but no one in their right mind..." Then she froze and made a small clicking noise at the back of her throat.
"Auger?"
"Fuck. I think you might actually be right."
"And there was me kind of hoping I'd be wrong."
"There were explosions in that debris cloud," she said, remembering the staccato flashes of light, as if something was still going on there, as if they were still fighting. "Who could have blown up that moon? If it wasn't deliberate, if it wasn't set off by demolition charges, then only the slashers could have done it." She followed the slow, fatigued churning of her exhausted mental processes. She was too tired to think clearly, or else she would never have considered the possibility that Phobos might have been blown up for her benefit. "That last flash," she said. "The really bright one."
"Yes?"
"I think that was the wormhole dying. We were surfing the collapsing end of it all the way home. We popped out, then the collapsing end of the pipe hit its own throat. It was like a stretched rubber band snapping back on itself. I think the blast took out all the combatants left near the debris cloud."
"And my way back home?"
"It's gone. The link is finished."
"I figured as much."
"I'm sorry, Floyd," she said.
"You don't have anything to apologize for. I got myself into this every step of the way."
"No, that isn't true. I have to take some of the blame. I should never have let you cross the sensor, and I definitely shouldn't have let you get aboard this ship.
Face it, kid, you'd never have got home without me."
She had no answer for that. He was right. Without Floyd's help, she would have died somewhere along the now-collapsed thread of the hyperweb, dashed to pieces in an unwitnessed fireworks display. "That still doesn't make it right," she said. "I've ripped you away from everything and everyone you ever knew. You had no choice." She touched her wound. It was hot and tender again, as if the inflammation had begun to return. The UR she had taken was not the kind that stayed inside the body forever. The little machines had probably dismantled themselves by now, donating their essence into the chemical reservoir of her body. She had assumed that she would be getting expert medical attention as soon as the ship popped into the recovery bubble.
"Are you all right?" Floyd asked. Just a bit crisp around the edges. I'll handle it.
You need medical attention.
And I'll get it just as soon as they pull us out of this can.
If they're looking for us, Floyd said.
They will be. Skelskad will have told Kaliskan that we're on our way back, and also that we have important information.
You ready to tell me a little more about why this matters so much? I mean, now that we're here.
Take a look out of the window again, Floyd. Take a look at Mars. Olga told him about Mars. She told him about Silver Rain and what it had done to that world.
Silver Rain was a weapon, cultivated during the last conflict between the Slashers and the Threshers, from samples of the original rogue nanotechnological spore that had ended life on Earth. With deft, snide brilliance, the military scientists of the Usni, aided by defectors from the polities who supplied the necessary expertise in nanotech manipulation, had taken the excessively crude bludgeon of the original spore and honed it into something sharp and rather lovely, like a samurai sword. Then they had seeded it into the thickening atmosphere of the partially terraformed Mars, the spore encased in myriad ceramic-jacketed ablative pellets, and it had sunk down to the surface, spreading across a vast footprint. The polities had never assumed that their enemies would use nanotechnology against them. It was the one thing that the Threshers abhorred above all else. It therefore made an ideal weapon of surprise. Silver Rain was very difficult to detect. The polity specialists on Mars were expecting something much cruder, and consequently, their nanotech filters were tuned to ignore something so fine, so cunning, so deadly. It infiltrated organisms quietly, initially doing no harm. Not just people and animals, but every living thing that the colonists had persuaded to survive on Mars. It slipped through seals and airlocks, through skin and cell membranes and the blood-brain barrier. Even the droves of nanotechnological mechanisms that the Slashers carried within their own bodies failed to recognize the intruder. It was that good. That precise. And for days it did nothing except insinuate itself more thoroughly into the colonists' world. It seeped into the irrigation system and used the canals to travel beyond the original infection footprint. It transmitted itself by means of physical contact between people and animals. It used the weather, riding the winds. It replicated itself, efficiently and systematically, but never consuming resources that would have drawn it to anyone's attention. People began to report that they were feeling a little under the weather, as if about to come down with a mild cold. But no one in the polities had come down with a cold in living memory. The Usni battle planners had programmed Silver Rain to trigger on the 28th of July 2243. It was a coincidence that the day and the month happened to be shared with the events of the Nanocaust. The timing of the Silver Rain deployment had been dictated by strategic considerations elsewhere in the war. But once that coincidence became apparent, the generals saw no need to alter their plans. It would send a signal, subtle or otherwise, to the polities. This is payback, it said. This is the price you pay for the harm your ideological ancestors did to Earth. When the trigger was operated, every infected organism died in the same convulsive instant as the machines erupted, little time bombs crammed inside every living cell. Recording systems showed people stopping in mid-stride, mid-sentence, mid-thought. They fell to the ground. Every biological event in their bodies aborted like a rogue computer process. They didn't bleed. They didn't even undergo any of the medically recognized phases of putrefaction. They just became a kind of dust, loosely organized into the shapes of corpses. When the cities and settlements began to fail, pressure containment systems breaking down through lack of human maintenance, the corpses simply blew away like so many piles of ash. It had never been the intention of Usni to destroy all life on the planet. They had too many Martian interests of their own to go that far. Had Silver Rain slipped from their control, it had never been tested on such a scale before, and its effects were not entirely predictable, they would have deployed a counterspore designed to neutralize the original weapon before it did excessive harm. But there was no need for that. The Silver Rain had worked exactly as advertised. In the aftermath, the Slasher forces were paralyzed by the scale of the atrocity. 60,000 people had died on Mars, more than the total number of casualties sustained in the conflict up to that point. But just when the Slashers were ready to launch a devastating counteroffensive against Tanglewood using weapons that they had kept in reserve until then,
there was an equally shocking turn of events amongst the Threshers. Senior officials denounced the actions of the battle planners who had developed and deployed Silver Rain. A moderately bloody coup followed, and those responsible for the crime against Mars were tried and executed. The punishments seemed to sate the Slashers. Within weeks, ceasefire terms had been agreed, with hostilities ended by late August. Mars returned to nominal Thresher control in 2244, but with significant concessions to the Slashers. While it was not exactly true to say that Mars had recovered from its assault, it had begun the healing process. The terraforming program soldiered on, never getting any closer to its goal, but it was something to live for regardless. Ambitious new settlements appeared in the Solis Planum and Terra Cimmeria regions, and the refurbishment of the high-orbit port, abandoned and mothballed during the war, brought a healthy dose of commerce. But even now, after 23 years, the scoured zone was still lifeless. By accident or design, the gene-tweaked crops never took root there again. None of the settlements inside the Silver Rain footprint were ever re-inhabited. They stood there now, half buried in Martian dust, bone-white ghost towns, left exactly as they had been at the time of the atrocity. Orga remembered her dream of Paris, the drummer boy on the Champs-Élysées. That was 23 years ago, she concluded. Officially, the weapon doesn't exist anymore. Even the blueprints were supposed to have been destroyed. But Susan White didn't write those words on a postcard for nothing. Someone's got hold of it again, maybe even improved it. And the next target isn't a few tens of thousands of Martian colonists. It's 3 billion people, the entire population of your version of Earth. But why? To erase what should never have been. To wipe out those 3 billion lives as if they were rogue programs in some vast computer simulation. To turn back the clock to the moment of the quantum snapshot and obtain a pristine copy of the Earth, unencumbered by anything as messy as living, breathing inhabitants. It's monstrous, Floyd said, horrified. From one point of view, from another it's simply a question of tidying up, like airbrushing a photograph. Remember what that war baby said in Berlin? All you really are to them is 3 billion dots. We have to stop this. And we're trying to, but we may be too late. If they already know the physical coordinates of the ALS, all they need to do now is to get there and deliver the Silver Rain. Then we have to get there ahead of them. Nice in theory, Floyd, but we don't know where the ALS is. There's an awful lot of galaxy out there. Then we need to find out those coordinates as well. They must have smuggled them out, right? Floyd, we're talking about three numbers. They don't even have to be big ones. No one needs to specify the position of the ALS to within a centimeter. It's like looking for an island in the Pacific Ocean. All you need is a grid reference accurate enough to rule out any other possibilities. Then we look for a grid reference. It could be anywhere, hidden in any form. It could be a telephone number or something even less obvious. But those numbers must be somewhere. Could they have been hidden in the thing Susan White was sending back home? She was on our side, Floyd. I'm not saying that she knew what she was carrying, just that she might have been acting as a courier for the bad guys without ever realizing it. It's still hopeless. Even if we knew for a fact that the numbers were in those papers, where would we start? The coordinates could be stored in the tiniest microdot, or in one telephone number amongst the thousands in the classified adverts. All I'm saying is that we have to do something. I agree, she said, but maybe our first priority ought to be getting rescued. Something distracted her, a slight change in the quality of light flooding the cabin. They were still tumbling, the sun still flashing through the window, once a rotation, but now there was a pinkish glow that stayed with them all the time, as if the transport was enveloped in its own little cloud of glowing light. You still think someone's going to pick us up? Floyd asked. They're looking for us, Orga said. Even if the blowing up of that moon wasn't part of the plan, someone will still want to know what happened to us. But even as she said it, she felt her certainty draining away. By its nature, the hyperweb portal was ultra-secret. Most of the people who knew anything about it would have been inside Phobos when the attack took it apart. Augur, I think we may be in more trouble than I first thought. Aveling and Barton are dead. Apart from Niagara and Kaliskan, I don't know who's left out there to look for us. Niagara and Kaliskan? Niagara's our slasher, Mole. the man who fed us the know-how to make the Phobos link operational in the first place. Caliscan is the man who sent me to recover Susan's belongings. Niagara may have been inside Phobos when it was destroyed, but Caliscan's probably still in Tanglewood. Then we'd better hope he hasn't forgotten about you. Floyd, there's something not right about this. She closed her eyes, silencing a moan as the discomfort in her shoulder took on a sharper, nastier edge. The more I think about it, the more I'm coming to believe that none of this was an accident. None of what? The collapse of the wormhole. Granted, the whole thing was becoming increasingly unstable, but the snake robot should have been able to compensate for that. It should have been able to manage a safe contraction of the throat. So what are you saying? I think the robot was sent there to destroy the link. But the robot helped you. Yes, she said, and it probably meant to save my life. I don't think it had any idea that it had been tampered with. The sabotage order could have been buried deep beneath its surface programming. The pink glow had intensified. Fingers of light now licked around the armored aperture of the window. It still bothered Auger, but she wasn't sure why. Why would anyone want to sabotage the link, if that's the only way back to Paris? Floyd asked. That's what worries me. Not just because it implies that someone within the organization set out to collapse the link, but also because it must mean that the Slashers no longer need it themselves. Why would they throw away something like that? They wouldn't, Auger said. Not unless they already had another way of reaching Paris. You mean they already have the coordinates of the ALS? Either that, or they're very close to finding them out. The thing that had been bothering Auger about that pink glow finally pushed its way to the front of her pain-fogged mind. She felt herself go quite cold, even the stab of the wound no longer her most immediate concern. Floyd, do something for me, will you? Climb up and take another look through the window. Why? You think someone else is out there? Just do it. She watched him intently as he did as he was told. Now tell me what I'm supposed to be looking for. Tell me if Mars looks any bigger than the last time you saw it. Floyd took a look and then stared back at her, light and shadow slipping over his face with clockwork regularity. His expression told her everything she needed to know. This isn't good, is it? Floyd asked. Get back in your seat, fast. What's wrong? What's wrong is that we're not in orbit around Mars. If that planet looks bigger, it's because it's closer. We're falling towards it. I think we're already skimming the upper atmosphere. Floyd returned to his seat and lost no time in buckling up. How do you know? I didn't, for a while. I just had a bad feeling that it might turn out this way. Phobos was in orbit around Mars, moving at exactly the right speed for its altitude. But we came out of the portal with our own velocity relative to the moon, hundreds of meters per second, at least. Whatever trajectory that put us in, it wasn't going to be the same one as Phobos. There's a chance we might have lucked out and had a boost in the right direction away from Mars. But today isn't our day for lucking out. No, she said. Doesn't look as if it is. We came out at the wrong angle, at the wrong speed. We're hitting the atmosphere. And that's as bad as it sounds, right? Ever wish upon a falling star, Floyd? Well, now's your big chance. You'll even get to be the star. What will happen? What will happen is that we'll burn up and die. If we're lucky, we'll have been crushed unconscious by the G-force before that happens. That's an interesting view of luck. This thing isn't made for atmospheric re-entry, Auger said, no matter what angle we come in at. This isn't the way it's meant to happen, Auger. Not like this. Not after we made it all this way. There's nothing we can do, she said. We can't steer this thing. We can't slow it down or speed it up. We can't even stop it tumbling. The glow, faint at first, had now intensified, flickering through shades of blue and pink, like a quilt of pastel light wrapped around the ship. It was mesmerizing and rather lovely. Under other circumstances, it might have been a thing of wonder. Maybe if the hull wasn't already shot to shit, she said, leaving Floyd to draw his own conclusions. But it is. I'm sorry, she said. This is all my fault. The glow flared to a hard white light, and in the same instant the transport shuddered violently. The tumbling motion became haphazard, and all around her, Auger heard shrieks and groans of protesting metal as the aerodynamic and thermal stresses of Mars's atmosphere began to toy with the fabric of the ship. G-force built up with surprising speed. It was nothing at all like the smooth insertions she remembered from her trips to Earth. One moment, All that was pushing her into her seat was the gentle and steady pressure of the unchecked rotation, and the next she was being pushed and pulled in random directions, yanked against the bruising restraints of the harness. She jammed her head into the shaped restraint at the back of the seat, trying to protect her neck from the whiplashing dead weight of her skull. The ride became even more turbulent, the noise deafening. She was beginning to find it difficult to breathe as the G-load worked against her lungs. She felt lightheaded, consciousness beginning to break into discrete, interrupted episodes. "Floyd," she managed to say. "Floyd, can you hear me?" When he answered, she could barely hear him over the scream of the dying transport. "You did good, Auger." How he managed it, she would never know. But somehow Floyd found the strength to reach out and close his hand around hers. She felt his fingers tighten, anchoring her to this place in space and time, even as everything else in her universe came apart in light and fury. 32. When she awoke, it was to the shining, cool whiteness she had always imagined heaven would be like. She would have happily stayed in that serene white limbo for the rest of eternity, void of any care or anxiety. But the whiteness held nagging suggestions of structure, pale shadows and highlights that sharpened themselves into the details of a room and its white-clad occupants. One of these occupants took on the form of a very beautiful girl, surrounded by a mirage of twinkling lights. "One lying little shit to the rescue," Cassandra said. Auger forced her way through layers of groggy recall, pushing memories back into place as she surfaced. "You," was all she managed to say. Cassandra nodded sagely. "Yes, me. I'm glad you remember. It would have made things a lot more difficult if there was deep amnesia." Auger became aware that she was lying on a bed, at a slight angle, with various twinkling machines hovering around her. Some were so tiny that at first glance they might have been mistaken for dust motes. Others were as large as dragonflies or hummingbirds, shimmering with the moiré patterns of intense microscopic detail. Dimly it occurred to her that, despite the absence of any lumbering items of bedside monitoring equipment, this was some kind of sickbay or recuperative ward. "We were falling. And we were tracking you, trying to intercept your transports before it hit the atmosphere. As you may have gathered, we only just got to you in time. Our medical science can work wonders, but it can't work miracles." Sweet relief that she had survived welled up inside her. Then she remembered that she had not been alone. "Is Floyd all right? The other occupant of the shuttle is fine. He's under observation in another room, but he didn't merit the immediate attention you did. And the transport? The transport is gone. We jettisoned its remains as a decoy. But don't worry, we emptied the cargo first." "Cargo?" "The archival items. A most interesting collection, I must say. I didn't load any cargo. It was the last thing on my mind before we left E2. Then she remembered the snake robot. Even as part of it was busy sabotaging the link, another part would have been diligently loading the transport with Susan White's accumulated possessions. It took a machine to be that stupid, Auger thought. "Okay, now tell me what the hell you're doing here. Other than saving your life. Oh, I thought that was obvious. I'm a spy, Auger. Ever since we picked up rumors and hints that you Threshers had reopened the Phobos portal, I've been trying to worm my way into Kaliskan's confidence in order to find out what's going on. And it worked, too, didn't it? That little trip to Earth was most invigorating. I always said you couldn't be trusted." "Ah, but the point is that you have no one else to trust. I'm your last best hope." "I think I'll take my chances with Niagara," Auger said. "Oh, yes, dear dependable Niagara. Shall I break the bad news now or later? Niagara was also a spy. The difference is that he was working for the really nasty people." The white walls were curved, merging seamlessly with floor and ceiling. Fine gold threads wove themselves through the white in calligraphic swirls that oozed and flowed in a way that seemed to calm Auger on some utterly primal level. "I don't believe you," she said, snapping her attention back to Cassandra. "Niagara showed us how to make the link work. Why would he have done that if he was working against us?" "Because he needed the link up and running, you silly Billy," Cassandra sighed, planting one hand on her hip. "Look, I'll spell it out for you. You were all duped. Niagara was a plant, working for a particularly vicious splinter faction of the aggressors. He wasn't a moderate sympathizer at all, but your worst enemy. Nice of you to let us know.
And nice of your government to let us know that it had found the Phobos portal in the first place, she countered.
If your people hadn't been so keen to keep that from us, we might have learned about Niagara's activity sooner than we did. Or you'd have made sure you controlled Niagara.
Are you going to keep this up forever, Augur? Or would it kill you to trust me?
I can't trust you, Cassandra. You lied to me on Earth, posing as someone you weren't.
At the behest of your government, not mine. It wouldn't have bothered me in the slightest if you'd known I was a polity citizen. It was Kaliskan who insisted on that particular charade.
That still doesn't excuse the fact that you were prepared to testify against me in the tribunal.
Testify as in tell the truth, you mean?
Well, I can't argue with that.
They'd have hung me out to dry.
And you'd have deserved it. Nothing was worth risking a human life the way you did, Orca. Especially not some useless paper relic from 200 years ago.
Is this the reason you rescued me?
To rub my nose in it.
Do I detect a note of contrition?
Detect what you like. You still haven't explained what you were doing around Mars, if you're so friendly.
We were doing what we could to limit the damage, Cassandra said. It can't have escaped your attention that there is civil war in the Federation of Polities. That disagreement has now spread to the inner system.
With Phobos, one of the first casualties, I hope you're proud of that.
Oh, very proud. Especially as 54 of my moderate friends died trying to defend your precious little moon. You can't imagine how proud that makes me feel.
I'm sorry, Augur said, chastened.
It doesn't matter.
They were just slashers, after all, she said bitterly.
I never realized.
The aggressors had been taking a particular interest in Phobos for some time, Cassandra said, ignoring her.
We had been shadowing their movements, trying to infiltrate their circles, but we didn't know what it was about Phobos that had them so excited.
Now you do.
You were in hyperweb transit when the moon was destroyed, weren't you?
Is there anything about us you don't know?
A great deal, Cassandra said. I haven't read your minds. We have no firm idea where the portal led to, or what you were doing at the other end. We don't know exactly what Niagara wanted with it, except that Silver Rain plays a role in his plans. But we have learned something puzzling about the man.
Floyd, you shouldn't have brought him with you.
I had no damned choice.
Augur forced herself to sit higher in the bed. As she moved, the bed effortlessly readjusted itself to support her. Beneath the silky white sheet, she was wearing some kind of hospital smock. She reached up and touched the area of her shoulder where she had been shot. No pain, no inflammation. She pushed her hand under the collar of the smock and traced the region of skin where the wound had been. It was baby smooth, revealing its healed newness only with the faintest tingle.
We dug out the bullet, Cassandra said. You were very lucky.
Where are we?
Aboard our ship, the one that pulled your transport out of Mars's atmosphere.
We called the ship, and her syrinx played one of its little ditties, although Augur heard none of the music in it.
I don't think there would be a lot of point in attempting a translation into flat language.
Where is the ship now? Are we still near Mars?
No, we're on our way to near-Earth space. There are, however, complications.
I need to talk to Kaliskan.
He's expecting you. It was a message from Kaliskan that warned us to keep an eye out for you. It was a moving transmission, probably sent from a ship. We're still tracking the message's point of origin. Once we're closer, we can open a tight beam channel.
Can I see Floyd in the meantime?
Cassandra made a precise mime-like gesture, signaling the machines hovering about her bed. A number of the smaller ones moved into Cassandra's own cloud, becoming part of its twinkling whole. She breathed in, and the cloud contracted to about half its previous volume.
I think you're allowed to move now, Cassandra said, after digesting whatever information the machines had imparted. But do take things carefully.
Augur started to force herself up from the bed. As soon as she moved, more hummingbirds and dragonflies appeared from nowhere and assisted her, exerting gentle pressure where she needed it. Her feet barely touched the floor. Once she was free of the bed, the sheet levitated, wrapped itself around her, and formed a kind of loose, billowing gown.
This way, Cassandra said.
The golden threads running through the walls oozed to form the outline of a doorway, which had a slightly Persian look to it. The door puckered wide, admitting them into a throat-like corridor with no recognizable floor or ceiling.
The corridor curved up and around, bringing them to a blank part of wall that obliged them with a doorway when they were close enough to touch it. They stepped through. Inside was a smaller recovery room than the one Orga had been in, containing a single bed with a single occupant. Floyd was asleep, lying flat on his back, a twinkle of machines around his head. The slashers had dressed him in a similar smock to the one Orga was wearing. His face was completely blank and mask-like, with no sign of his head injury.
"He looks dead," Orga said.
"He isn't. Just unconscious. We're holding him that way for the time being."
"Why?"
"We didn't want to alarm him." Cassandra's cloud commingled with the machines around Floyd, some brief information exchange taking place. "When we healed his head wound, we naturally examined his DNA. It turned out to be very peculiar. He doesn't have any of the chromosomal markers that would identify him as a descendant of someone who lived through the GM excursions of the early 21st century.
"He wouldn't," Orga said.
"It would take extensive rescripting to remove those markers. Why would anyone go to so much trouble?"
"They wouldn't."
"That's what we thought." Cassandra touched a finger to her lower lip. "It's almost as if he's a man from the past, from before the 21st century."
"Good guess.
What else did you figure out?" "He must have come through the hyperweb, from the other end of the link."
"What did you find there, Orga?"
"If I don't tell you, you'll just take it from my memory, won't you? If I decided you were withholding something of strategic importance, I'm afraid I'd have little choice. Regrettably, this is war."
He surfaced to the sound of Orga's voice. She came into focus, looking down on him against a background of spotless cinematic white.
"Floyd, wake up. You're okay."
His mind was as clean and clear as the dawn sky. He was vaguely affronted by this on some level, feeling that he should have been allowed a grace period of disorientation and grogginess. Even his memories felt bright and sparkling, as if they had been taken out for a quick spit and polish. He ran his tongue around the inside surface of his teeth. None of them were broken. They felt like church gargoyles that had been taken down and sandblasted clean. "What happened?" he asked.
"We were rescued," Orga said.
She was standing over his bed wearing a kind of satin toga. It moved around her in strange, unsettling ways, flowing like one of those very flat fish that skim the seabed.
"We're all right, at least for now."
He sat up and touched his scalp. There was no sign of the injury, although his hair had been shaved almost to his scalp where the cut had been.
"Where is this place?"
"We're aboard a ship."
"A spaceship?"
"Yes. You can cope with that, can't you? I mean, after what's happened to us, a spaceship is not the strangest thing imaginable, is it?"
"I'll cope," Floyd said.
"Who's running this jalopy? And are they the good guys?" "I know the woman who seems to be in charge. She's a moderate slasher by the name of Cassandra. I've already had dealings with her on Earth. In theory, that makes her more trustworthy than the aggressors."
"You don't sound convinced."
"They've taken care of us. It doesn't mean they have my automatic gratitude. Not until I know what's going on, and where exactly they're taking us."
"Haven't they told you?"
"They're supposed to be homing in on the location of some kind of transmission from Kaliskan. That's all I know." Floyd rubbed a hand across his face. They had even shaved him. It was, by some distance, the best shave he had ever had. "You don't like them much, do you?"
"I liked them even less after..."
But she stopped and shook her head. "If she wants to know everything, she can damn well work for it. The only person I want to talk to is Kaliskan." Floyd pushed himself upright. He was on the point of asking Orga if she knew where he might get a drink when the dryness in his throat was suddenly gone, as if he had been imagining it all along.
"What did you tell Cassandra?" he asked.
"I told her everything. If she'd suspected I was holding anything back, she'd have read my mind anyway."
"How'd she take... me?"
"I'm not sure she thought your being here was a great idea."
"That makes two of us," Floyd said. "I also know there isn't much point in complaining about it."
"I'm sorry about all this."
"Augur, do me a favor and stop apologizing, will you? No regrets. Never."
She smiled. "I don't believe you for a second, but I'm still glad you made it, Floyd."
"I'm glad we both made it. Now how about a kiss before they come to put me in the monkey house?"
At first, Orga thought that Cassandra had somehow lost her way and led them into the wrong part of the ship,
Some kind of waiting room or chill-out den, perhaps, but definitely not a tactical room. It was another white chamber, brightly lit where she had expected subdued vision-enhancing reds. Instead of urgent cycling displays, the walls were the usual gold-threaded white. There was a toadstool-shaped table in the middle of the room, rising seamlessly from the floor, and around this stood half a dozen toadstool-shaped chairs. The chairs had a spongy, haphazard look to them, like the furniture of a gingerbread house. Six slashers occupied them, facing each other across the equally spongy table. None of them were in what Orga would have called a tense or particularly agitated posture. One of them rested an elbow on the table, hand supporting his chin. Another woman, although she could have passed for a child, pressed her steepled fingers to her brow as if in meditation. The other four slashers had their hands tucked limply in their laps, as if they were waiting their turns in a slow, dull parlor game. No one was saying anything, and their eyes were either closed or heavy-lidded. There was, however, a dense cloud of twinkling machines hovering above the middle of the table, and the extremities of this cloud encompassed all six participants, its boundary shifting from moment to moment.
"Tunguska," Cassandra said, "can you spare enough of yourself to talk to us?"
The one with his elbow on the table turned his head minutely in their direction. He was a large man, black-skinned and round of face, with sad, heavy-lidded eyes, and long, silver-black hair tied back in a ponytail. "I can always make time for you, Cassie," he said in a very slow, very deep voice.
"Tunguska is my battle manager," Cassandra said. "He's also my friend and ally. Tunguska and I go back a long way.
I didn't know an outmoded concept like friendship was tolerated in the polities," Orga said.
"Then you know even less about us than you think."
Cassandra nodded at Tunguska.
"Our guests are curious. Can you show them the state of play?"
"Let me see what I can do."
Tunguska turned to the wall and with brisk hand gestures somehow made an area of it become black. Circles and spheres dropped into place, a view of the solar system, looking down on the plane of the ecliptic. The view zoomed in on the inner system, as far out as the orbit of Mars. Mars itself was indicated by a red sphere, very much out of scale, accompanied by one intact moon and the glowing smudge that had recently been Phobos. The collapse of the quasi-wormhole knocked out all forces within a few dozen kilometers of the moon, Tunguska said, his voice as slow and measured as if he was reciting a sermon. But that still leaves a large concentration of ships within the immediate volume of space around Mars. We're tracking at least 200 distinct thrust signatures.
Who do those ships belong to? Orga asked.
Everyone who has a stake in controlling the inner system. Various polity factions account for about 70% of active combatants. 20% are Usni, with the remainder made up of non-aligned parties, lunar breakaway groups and such like. As Tunguska spoke, icons dropped into place, forming a bustling crowd of flags and emblems around Mars. It was quite impossible to make any sense of it.
Did anyone make it out of Phobos alive? Orga asked.
We're tracking a number of slow-moving spacecraft that seem to have left Phobos before the main attack commenced.
Why?
Asked Cassandra. Were you thinking of anyone in particular?
I had a friend,
Orga said, faltering.
I didn't really know her very well, but I want to believe she got away in time. I'm afraid I can't offer any guarantees, Cassandra said.
Perhaps reading something in her face, she continued. However, it seems at least plausible that some people...
There's a good chance she made it, Tunguska said.
Never mind, Orga said. The last thing she needed right now was empty reassurance. She would just have to hope that Skelskad had been on one of those early ships. Just give me a straight answer to my next question. Who's winning?
If you don't mind, Tunguska said, addressing Cassandra, I really need to focus on the task in hand, or the answer to her question is not going to be one we'd all wish for. He nodded at Floyd and Orga. It was nice to meet you. I hope you both make it home safely.
He turned his head back to face the table and closed his eyes.
I'll answer your question, Cassandra said. There is no clear outcome in sight. If it was a straight contest between polity and thresher assets, there'd be little doubt of victory for the polities, at least around Mars. But the moderates are siding with the threshers. So far, that's evening things out.
Then let's hope things reach a stalemate, Auger said. Floyd, standing beside her, had said nothing so far, but he still nodded, evidently sharing her concern. Cassandra shook her head. Wishful thinking, I'm afraid. The moderates have deployed all their assets into the inner system, but the aggressors still have forces in reserve. They're on high burn approaches even as we speak. But this is insane, Auger said. They might have the military strength to take Mars from us, and they might even have the means to capture Tanglewood and the rest of the inner system. But the moderates won't let them do that without a fight, and they still have that little scorched earth problem to worry about.
What scorched earth problem? Floyd asked.
My side ringed earth with bombs, Auger said. Insurance against the slashers trying to take it out of our hands again.
You mean you'd blow up the planet rather than let someone else have it?
In a nutshell, yes.
I hate to tell you this, Auger, but you're all as crazy as each other.
Bet you're sorry you signed up for this now, aren't you, Floyd?
Not waiting for his answer, Auger turned back to Cassandra.
Where are we in this sorry little mess?
Oh, we're nowhere near Mars now, the girl said.
We've been on our own high-burn trajectory ever since we snatched you out of the atmosphere.
Another icon dropped into the image, about halfway between Mars and Earth, which were both situated on the same side of the sun.
That's us. That's us, Cassandra confirmed, maintaining a high-burn trajectory, with a second ship just behind us.
A high-burn trajectory?
Auger shook her head. It doesn't even feel as if we're moving.
Trust me, we're moving. We're also executing some rather violent evasive patterns.
Something wasn't right.
Auger had heard many things about the Slasher's advanced technology, but she had never heard that they had developed the means to nullify acceleration. Perhaps they were even further ahead of the Uzni than intelligence had ever suggested.
What do you know about this second ship? She asked.
We think it might be one of Niagara's allies, or possibly the man himself. It's a polity design, part of the original concentration of aggressor elements. It may be responding to Kaliskan's signal from Tanglewood.
We have to get to him first, Auger said.
That's more or less the idea,
Cassandra replied laconically. We'd be there in 8 hours under optimum conditions. Unfortunately, the ship behind us is doing its best to make life difficult. These violent evasive maneuvers are costing us time and engine fatigue.
Maybe I'm missing something, Auger said, but I don't feel any violent evasive maneuvers.
Cassandra said thoughtfully. There's something you need to see, I think.
What?
Cassandra led them across the chamber and opened a door into another corridor. A little way along, she stopped at a smooth expanse of convex walling and created an observation window.
I may as well show you something else on the way. Apart from the two of you, there are 18 other casualties on this ship.
Auger brightened, remembering Skelskad. Perhaps she was safe after all, despite Cassandra's doubts.
Refugees from Phobos? Not directly, no. I'm sorry. I know you want good news about your friend, and I would give it to you if I could.
The observation window overlooked a large interior chamber. Cassandra made the lights come on, revealing the stubby, streamlined form of a Thresher-manufactured spacecraft, the kind that could skim in and out of an atmosphere and land on a planetary surface, such as Mars or Titan, or on one of the high-altitude landing towers on Venus. It was about 20 meters in length, just small enough to fit into the bay. The shuttle had bulky thrust nacelles and bulging insectile undercarriage pods. Against the scorched white skin, Auger could make out a green flying horse logo near the black heat-absorbent paneling of the nose.
That's a Pegasus intersolar ship, she said.
Yes, Cassandra said. As a matter of fact, it's a transatmospheric shuttle from the liner 20th Century Limited. The ship was braced into the chamber on enormous shock-absorbing pistons, gripping it from all angles. Even as Auger watched, the ship lurched one way and then another, as if subject to immense lateral forces.
I took the 20th to Phobos, she said, feeling slightly seasick. What's one of its shuttles doing here?
The liner was hijacked. Hostile ships made rendezvous and hard docking beyond reach of system-wide law enforcement.
Slasher forces.
Not obviously so. According to eyewitnesses, they behave just like your run-of-the-mill extra-legal agents. Pirates, in other words. Luckily, the liner was running at nowhere near maximum capacity.
There was room for most of the passengers and crew to escape on shuttles.
And the pirates just let them go? Orga asked incredulously.
They had nothing to gain by butchering those on board. There wasn't enough room for everyone on the shuttles, and some of the crew elected to remain aboard. They were allowed into a secure compartment with life support capability and provisions. That's where the ones who stayed aboard were all found, when the 20th drifted within reach of Thresher police. Orga thought she had misheard her.
Drifted?
She had been gutted, Cassandra said, stripped of her entire drive assembly.
That's insane.
Oh, there was some attempt to dress up the piracy as being for the usual reasons, she said, but it was all cover, really. The main thing they were after was the drive core.
But why would anyone want the drive core of an old junk heap like the 20th?
The Slashers will happily sell anyone a more efficient engine, provided they stump up the costs.
That's precisely what bothered me,
Cassandra said. The entire operation to steal the 20th's engine must have been quite expensive in its own right. Several ships had to make that rendezvous, including one large enough to contain the entire drive assembly. It's not the sort of thing you dismantle.
It doesn't make any sense, Orga said.
But you sense a connection nonetheless. Why steal an antimatter engine when we can offer something infinitely safer, and just as powerful? The only practical use for such a thing would be
as a bomb, Orga said.
I'm sorry? Think about it, Cassandra. It has to be a bomb. That's the only thing that drive can give the Slashers that you don't already have. Your bleed drive engines suck energy from the vacuum in tiny controlled doses. I know. I've seen the sales brochures.
They're very safe, Cassandra said defensively. The vacuum potential reaction is self-limiting. If the energy density exceeds a critical limit, it shuts off.
In other words, very useful for making a safe drive, but not much use as a Molotov cocktail.
Beside her, Floyd smiled. I almost thought I was going to get through a whole conversation without understanding a single word. Now you've gone and spoiled it.
I confess I have no idea what a Molotov cocktail is, Cassandra said. Is it some kind of weapon system?
You could say that, Floyd said.
I still don't understand, Cassandra said. You're implying that someone wanted the antimatter engine to use as a bomb. But what use is such a thing? A ship large enough to contain the stolen drive assembly could never approach close enough to a planet or habitat to do serious damage. It would be intercepted and destroyed in interplanetary space, light seconds from any target. As soon as we issue a system-wide alert...
Go ahead and issue your alert, Orga said, but I don't think it will make any difference. I think you'll find it a lot more difficult to track those ships than you're expecting.
I also don't think they intend to use that antimatter against anything in this system.
You're making me most anxious to have a peek inside your skull, Cassandra said ominously. I thought we had an agreement.
And you said you had something else to show me.
It concerns the evacuees, she said, and in a way, you.
She made the window vanish, then led them a little further along the corridor and opened another gilded doorway. The room beyond was a kind of dormitory. Inside, ranked against the two long incurving walls, were 20 or so coffin-like containers. Again, they had the spongy vegetative look of recently extruded hardware, their bases merging into the floor. Pulpy, root-like tendrils connected the pods to each other and the walls.
This is where we're keeping the 18 passengers and crew from the shuttle, Cassandra said, inviting Orga to take a closer look at one of the pods.
The upper part of it consisted of a curved, glossy lid, veined like a leaf, through which the head and upper body of one of the evacuees could just be discerned. She was a tall, dark-skinned woman, encased in what looked like a thick turquoise-blue support matrix of some kind. Orga even thought she recognized her as one of the other passengers she'd seen on the 20th.
"Is she ill?" Orga asked.
"No," Cassandra said. "See that bluish gel she's floating in? Pure machinery. It's invaded her completely, right down to the cellular level."
Who gave you permission to do that? Orga asked, outraged. These people are threshers. Most of them would never consent to having machines pumped into their bodies.
I'm afraid they didn't have a lot of choice in the matter, Cassandra said. It was either that or die.
We can quibble over consent later.
Die of what? You just said that none of them were ill.
It's the evasive pattern, you see. We're sustaining 10 Gs, which would be bad enough in its own right. But our random maneuvers superimpose 1 or 200 G transients on top of that background load.
It's quite intolerable for an unmodified person. Without the buffering from those machines, they'd be dead.
Then why aren't we? Orga asked.
I'll show you.
Cassandra waved them through to the back of the dormitory. I mentioned 18 evacuees from the 20th, she said, but you'll notice that there are 20 caskets in this room. We wouldn't have bothered creating the extras without good reason.
She gestured to the last two, set against the far wall.
You and your companion are in those two.
Wait,
Orga began.
There's no reason for alarm, Cassandra said. Come closer and look inside. You'll see that you're perfectly unharmed.
Orga looked through the transparent cover of the first casket. There, suspended in the same blue gel as the woman, lay the sleeping form of Floyd, his eyes closed, his face an unmoving mask of serenity. She stepped aside to let him see, then viewed her own body in the other casket.
Why does this feel as if everything just turned into a bad dream? Floyd asked.
It's all right, Orga said, reaching out to squeeze his hand in an attempt to give reassurance that she didn't really feel herself. No matter how much this bothered her, she could not begin to imagine what Floyd was feeling. Isn't it, Cassandra?
I didn't want to alarm you immediately, the slasher said, knowing how threshers tend to feel about our machines.
She's telling the truth, Orga said to Floyd. We are on a spaceship and we were rescued from Mars. I'm pretty certain that much is true. But we still haven't been woken up.
I feel pretty awake for someone who hasn't been woken up.
You're fully conscious, she said. It's just that the machines are fooling your brain into thinking that you're walking around. Everything that you see or feel is bogus. You're really still in that tank.
It's the only way we can keep you alive, Cassandra said with evident concern. The acceleration would have killed all of us by now.
So you're... Floyd began, not really knowing how to frame the question. In another casket, as are all my colleagues somewhere else in the ship. I'm sorry that a small white lie was necessary, but everything else I've told you was the truth.
Everything? Asked Orga.
Cassandra cleared a portion of the wall and created a three-dimensional grid into which she dropped the tiny form of their ship. It veered and swerved, the ship's lithe, flexible hull bending and twisting with each change of direction.
This is our real-time trajectory, Cassandra said. You saw a hint of it when I showed you the captive shuttle. I could have doctored the view. It would have been trivial. But I chose not to. You'd have guessed sooner or later.
Are we really all right? Orga said.
Absolutely, Cassandra said, although the healing processes are still taking place. You'll both be good as new by the time we arrive at Tanglewood.
If we ever get there, she said.
Cassandra smiled. Let's on the side of optimism, shall we? In my experience, there's very little point worrying about something you can't control.
Even death.
Most especially death.
33. Orga was picking her way through an orange when Cassandra reappeared, stepping through a curtained doorway that rippled in an imaginary breeze. The girl-shaped slasher made a chair appear from nowhere, then lowered herself into it.
How are you feeling?
This is the best fruit I've ever tasted. Orga replied.
The best fruit you've never tasted, Cassandra said, correcting her with an amused smile. It's rather unfair, of course. How could any real food compare with direct stimulation of the taste center?
Being reminded that the orange was a figment of her imagination was enough to kill what little of her appetite remained.
Is this what it's like for you every day?
Orga asked. Beside her, Floyd continued to attack a bunch of grapes.
More or less.
I suppose you get used to it in the end, being able to experience anything you want, when and wherever you want to.
It has its attractions, Cassandra said, but so does unlimited access to candy when you're a child. The simple fact of the matter is that we learn to live with what we have, and the novelty begins to wear off after a while. The machines in my environment can reshape any room, any space, according to my immediate needs. If the machines can't respond quickly enough, or there's a conflict with someone else's requirements, I can tell other machines in my head to achieve the same thing by manipulating my perceptions. If there's a memory that troubles me, I can erase or bury it, or program it to surface only when I need some reminder of my shortcomings. If there's an emotion I find unpleasant, I can turn it off or lessen it.
Like anxiety about the future.
Anxiety is a useful tool. It forces us to make plans. But when too much anxiety freezes us into indecision, it needs checking.
Cassandra leaned back in her seat,
making the wooden joints creak. She reached for an apple from a bowl on a nearby table and bit into it. It's a matter of balance, you see. These things may sound miraculous to you, but to me they're simply part of the texture of my life.
Floyd pushed aside his plate. It sounds like heaven to me. You can make anything happen, or at least make yourselves think it's happened, and you'll live forever.
Cassandra's people have no past, Orga said. We don't have much of one, but what we do have is sacrosanct.
I'm not sure I follow, Floyd said.
Everyone alive today is a descendant of someone who was living in space when the nanocaust hit, Orga elaborated. No one on the surface of the planet made it out alive. So we're all descended from the colonists who had already begun to settle the solar system. She looked at the slasher.
True, Cassandra?
True enough. But getting into space was difficult back then. Every gram had to be accounted for, argued over, justified at the expense of another gram. We didn't bring books when we could make do with digital scans of the texts, preserved in computer memory. We didn't bring films or photographs when we could more easily transport digital versions of them. We didn't even bring animals or flowers, making do with transcriptions of their DNA. It went the same way for both of our ancestral peoples, Cassandra added, the only difference being that Augur's grouping, the ancestors of the Usni, embraced the digital with slightly less gusto than we did. They were cautious, rightly so, as it happened.
We brought some physical artifacts into space, Augur said, a few books, photographs, even some animals. It cost us terribly, but we sensed that the storage of so much knowledge in the form of digital records, in the memories of machines, made us vulnerable.
After the nanocaust, when we'd seen machines go wrong on such a scale, we embarked on a crash program to convert as much of that electronically stored information as possible back into solid analog format. We made printing presses to produce physical books. We burnt digital images back onto chemical plates. We had factories churning out paper as fast as our printers could swallow it. We even had armies of scribes copying texts back onto paper in longhand in case the printers failed before the work was done. We did everything we could think of doing, to make copies we could touch and smell, like in the old days. It almost worked, too, but we just weren't fast enough.
We call it the forgetting, Cassandra said. It happened about 50 years after the nanocaust, when our respective societies had regained some measure of stability and self-sufficiency, following the death of Earth. Even now, no one really knows what caused it. Sabotage is sometimes mentioned, but I'm inclined to think it was an accident. Just one of those things waiting to happen.
The digital records crashed, Orga said. Overnight, some kind of virus or worm spread through every linked archive in the system. Texts were turned into garbled junk. Pictures, movies, even music were scrambled into senselessness.
Some archives survived, Cassandra said, but after the forgetting, we could never be certain of their reliability.
We lost almost everything, Orga said. All we had left of the past was fragments. It was like trying to reconstruct the entirety of human knowledge from a few books saved from a burning library.
What about institutions? Floyd asked. Didn't they keep the originals of all this stuff?
They'd been falling over themselves to shred and pulp their paper collections for years, Orga said. They couldn't do it quickly enough. Once they'd been sold on the idea that they could reduce all this cumbersome volume to a single sheet of microfiche, or a single optical disc, or a single partition in a flash memory array, or whatever was being hailed as the latest and best storage medium that week.
Perfect sound forever, Cassandra said, in the manner of someone reciting an advertising slogan.
That, at least, was the idea. It's just such a shame that it didn't actually work. You see now why our people have followed two paths. The Threshers believe that the forgetting must never be allowed to happen again. To that end, they abstain from the very technologies that could offer them immortality.
No one's immortal, Orga said sharply. You're just immortal until the next nanocaust, or the next forgetting, or until the sun blows up. And any one of us is free to defect to the polities if we don't like living under the iron rule of the Threshold Committee.
A fair point, Cassandra said. We, on the other hand, have decided not to worry about the past. We've lost it once, so why worry about losing it again? We live in the moment.
She extended her hand and made the room change, expanding it massively, the white walls racing away in all directions. Suddenly they were in a space the size of a cathedral, and then a skyscraper. It kept on growing,
the walls receding until they were kilometers or tens of kilometers away, the ceiling rocketing into the sky until it took on the blue of the atmosphere itself, with a layer of cloud suspended just below it. The room's open window now looked out into star-sprinkled night. It was a bravura display of control, but Cassandra wasn't finished. She narrowed her eyes, and the distant walls flickered with a vast sculptural detail. Fluted columns and caryatids as tall as mountains, buttresses and arches leaning across absurd reaches of empty space. She made stained glass windows open into the walls, shot through with light in a spectrum Augur had never imagined. Cassandra must have been tweaking her brain on a fundamental level, altering her very perceptual wiring. Not only were the colors unfamiliar and heart-wrenchingly beautiful, but she could hear them, feel them, smell them. She had never known anything so lovely, so sad, so wonderful. "Please stop," she said, overwhelmed. Cassandra returned the room to its prior dimensions. "I'm sorry," she said to Augur and Floyd in turn, "but I felt that some demonstration was necessary to illustrate what I understand as living in the moment. That's the kind of moment I mean."
"I have just one question," Floyd said. "If you can do this, if you can have everything you want, whenever and wherever you want it, then why are some of you so keen on getting your hands on Earth?"
"That's a shrewd question," Cassandra said. "So answer it," Augur said. "We want Earth, because it is the one thing we cannot have," Cassandra said. "And that, for some of us, is intolerable."
Cassandra was waiting when the veined lid peeled aside.
"Well, Augur, was the reintegration as painless as I predicted? I'll cope. Can you help me out of this thing?"
"Certainly."
Another slasher was already helping Floyd out of his casket. Augur looked around with bleary eyes while the last remnants of the blue fluid gathered into larger blobs and flowed back into the open maw of the casket.
"Come," Cassandra said. "I'll bring you up to speed. We're very near Earth."
They returned to the tactical room, which was almost as Augur remembered it, except for the absence of any slashers.
"They're still in their acceleration caskets," Cassandra explained. "If we need to make a sudden movement, they'll be better able to manage the tactical situation."
"Are we still being chased by Niagara?"
"Niagara, or whoever was in that ship, isn't a problem anymore. It ran into one of our missiles just before we reached the outer cordon of Tanglewood defenses."
"You mean he's dead?"
"Someone's dead. It may or not be Niagara. If it isn't, we'll find him sooner or later."
"You better had."
"Perhaps if you told me exactly why it was so important to reach Kaliskan, I might be able to do a little more to help you."
"I've told you as much as you need to know," Augur said firmly.
"You only told me half of the story, and I'm not quite ready to trust you with the rest of it. Maybe when I've spoken to Kaliskan. Are you close enough to send a tight beam message to him?" "There'll always be a slight risk of interception, but yes, we're close enough now."
With a flourish of her fingers, a gesture that Augur suspected was as much theatrical as anything else, Cassandra assigned part of the wall as a flat screen. For a moment it was blank, awaiting a response.
"You may speak," she said, prompting Augur with a nod of her head.
"What's my location?" she asked. Cassandra told her.
"Kaliskan," she said, "this is Verity Augur. I believe you wanted to hear from me. I'm alive and well, within half a light second of Tanglewood. I'm aboard a slasher spacecraft, so you'll have to pull some strings to let me get any closer without all hell breaking loose."
A second or two later, the assigned panel lit up with swaths of blocky primary colors, which quickly sharpened into a flickering low-time resolution pixel image.
"That's Kaliskan,"
Floyd said, when the face of the white-haired man had assumed a recognizable shape.
"The man who sent me to Paris, and the only one who has a hope of sorting out this mess," Augur said.
"Face looks familiar. It's almost as if I know him," Floyd said, peering more closely at the image.
"You can't possibly know him," she said. "You've never met him."
Floyd touched the side of his head as if in salute.
"Whatever you say, Chief."
Kaliskan's glasses flared light back at the camera. "Augur, you're alive. You can't imagine how much this pleases me. Please pass my thanks on to Cassandra. I didn't dare believe you'd made it out of the Phobos catastrophe."
"We made it, sir. Both of us did."
She waited for the response.
The one-second delay was just long enough to impose a certain stiltedness on the conversation, as if both of them were speaking a language neither felt comfortable with.
"Both of you, Augur? But Skelskard said that the war babies had killed Aveling and Barton before you helped her escape."
"And so they did, sir. I'm with a man called Floyd, who was born on E2. Behind Kaliskan, she could make out the ribs, spars, and instruments of a spacecraft cabin interior, a modern Thresher ship, but something much less advanced than the slasher vessel she had woken up inside.
"That's a serious development," he said.
"There's more we need to talk about," Augur said. "Can you clear our approach with the Tanglewood authorities?"
"Check the news, Augur. There are no authorities. The Tanglewood administration's made a run for the hills. I'm already having a hard time evading the pirates and looters, and I have a fast shuttle."
"My children are in Tanglewood."
"No," he said. "Peter took them away a couple of days ago. As soon as Skelskard came through, we began to fear that something bad was imminent. Your children are safe."
"Where are they?"
"Peter thought it best not to tell anyone. He said he'd make contact with you as soon as the situation calms down."
Augur closed her eyes and said a small, silent prayer of thanks. "Sir," Augur said after a moment, "I have important news. There's something I really need to tell you. I know what Susan White was onto, and it's big. You have to act now. Use all your contacts to pull in assistance before it's too late."
"It's all right," Kaliskan said. "We figured out most of the details from Skelskard. It was remarkably brave of you to send her back the way you did."
"Is she all right?"
"Yes, she's fine. Safe and sound." That was another debt to add to the pile. Her children were safe, and so was her small, scowling friend from Phobos.
"I still need to talk to you," she said. "Can you suggest a suitable rendezvous point?"
"I already have a place in mind. It's somewhere the pirates and looters won't dare follow us. I suspect even the slashers will have second thoughts."
She knew exactly where he meant, and it scared her. "You're not serious, Kaliskan."
"I'm more than serious. Does that ship you're in have trans-atmospheric capability?"
She turned to Cassandra.
"Well?"
"We can fly in. But there's more to a trip to Earth than just flying in. A Thresher ship may be sufficiently robust for the Furies not to pose an immediate risk, but we are rather more susceptible. I thought the Slashers had protection against Furies now. Isn't that why you're so keen to get your hands on Earth?"
"Experimental countermeasures," Cassandra said, "which, I regret to inform you, this ship doesn't happen to be carrying."
Augur turned back to Kaliskan. "No dice. She says the ship isn't equipped to fend off Furies. We'll have to pick another RV point."
"Tell her not to worry," Kaliskan said. "The Fury count near my designated RV is low. I know because I have direct feeds from antiquities monitoring stations in the vicinity. Our enemies won't have this information, which is why they won't be so keen to come charging in."
Augur glanced at Cassandra. "Does that sound reasonable to you?"
"He spoke of a low count, not a zero one," Cassandra said. "I can't risk taking my ship deep into the atmosphere, especially with 18 evacuees in my care."
"This is very important."
"In which case," Cassandra said, "we'll have to consider an alternative means of transportation."
"You mean the 20th shuttle?"
"There isn't much fuel left aboard, but it should still be capable of making the round trip."
"Can it fly itself?"
"It doesn't have to," Cassandra said. "I can take care of that."
Augur returned her attention to the screen. "We're following you in, but we'll need a few minutes to get our act together. Don't get too far ahead of us."
"Make it as quick as you can," Kaliskan said. "And if you have any cargo from Paris, now might not be a bad time to hand it over to me. Given what's happened around Mars, it may be the last consignment we ever see."
"There isn't much," Augur said. "Just a few boxes that the snake robot put on the transport before it sabotaged the link."
"You're still working for antiquities. Bring what there is. Then follow my trajectory precisely, no matter how inefficient it looks."
"Where are you taking us, sir?"
"For a dinner engagement," Kaliskan said. "We're dining with the ghost of Guy de Maupassant. I just hope he doesn't mind the company."